This is Audible.
Ulysses by James Joyce. Stately plump Buck Mulligan came from the stairhead, bearing a bowl of lather on which a mirror and a razor lay crossed. A yellow dressing gown, ungirdled, was sustained gently behind him by the mild morning air. He held the bowl aloft and intoned, "Intro weebo ad altare dei!" Halted, he peered down the dark winding stairs and called up coarsely, "Come up, Kinch! Come up, you fearful Jesuit!" Solemnly, he came forward and mounted the round gunrest. He faced about and blessed gravely thrice the tower, the surrounding country, and the awaking mountains. Then, catching sight of Stephen Dedalus, he bent towards him and made rapid crosses in the air, gurgling in his throat and shaking his head. Stephen Dedalus, displeased and sleepy, leaned his arms on the top of the staircase and looked coldly at the shaking, gurgling face that blessed him, equine in its length, and at the light, untonsured hair, grained and hued like pale oak. Buck Mulligan peeped an instant under the mirror, and then covered the bowl smartly.
"Back to barracks," he said sternly.
He added, in a preacher's tone,
"For this, O dearly beloved, is the genuine Christine, body and soul and blood and oons. Slow music, please. Shut your eyes, gents, one moment. A little trouble about those white corpuscles. Silence, all."
He peered sideways up and gave a long, low whistle of call, then paused a while in rapt attention, his even white teeth glistening here and there with gold points. Chrysostomus. Two strong, shrill whistles answered through the calm.
"Thanks, old chap," he cried briskly. "That'll do nicely. Switch off the current, will you?"
He skipped off the gunrest and looked gravely at his watcher, gathering about his legs the loose folds of his gown. The plump, shadowed face and sullen oval jowl recalled a prelate, patron of arts in the Middle Ages. A pleasant smile broke quietly over his lips.
"The mockery of it," he said gaily. "Your absurd name, an ancient Greek."
He pointed his finger in friendly jest and went over to the parapet, laughing to himself. Stephen Dedalus stepped up, followed him wearily halfway, and sat down on the edge of the gunrest, watching him still as he propped his mirror on the parapet, dipped the brush in the bowl, and lathered cheeks and neck. Buck Mulligan's gay voice went on.
"My name is absurd, too. Malachy Mulligan, two dactyls. But it has a Hellenic ring, hasn't it? Tripping and sunny, like the book himself. We must go to Athens. Will you come if I can get the aunt to fork out 20 quid?
He laid the brush aside and, laughing with delight, cried,
"Will he come? The jejun Jesuit!"
Ceasing, he began to shave with care. "Tell me, Mulligan," Stephen said quietly.
"Yes, my love."
"How long is Haynes going to stay in this tower?" Buck Mulligan showed his shaven cheek over his right shoulder.
"God, isn't he dreadful?" he said frankly. "A ponderous Saxon. He thinks you're not a gentleman. God, these bloody English, bursting with money and indigestion, because he comes from Oxford. You know, Dedalus, you have the real Oxford manner. He can't make you out." "Oh, my name for you is the best. Kinch the knife blade."
He shaved warily over his chin. "He was raving all night about a black panther," Stephen said. "Where is his gun case?"
"A woeful lunatic," Mulligan said. "Were you in a funk?"
"I was," Stephen said, with energy and growing fear. "Out here in the dark with a man I don't know, raving and moaning to himself about shooting a black panther. You save men from drowning. I'm not a hero, however. If he stays on here, I'm off." Buck Mulligan frowned at the lather on his razor blade. He hopped down from his perch and began to search his trouser pockets hastily.
"Scutter!"
he cried thickly. He came over to the gunrest and, thrusting a hand to Stephen's upper pocket, said,
"Lend us the loan of your nose rag to wipe me razor."
Stephen suffered him to pull out and hold up on show by its corner a dirty, crumpled handkerchief. Buck Mulligan wiped the razor blade neatly. Then, gazing over the handkerchief, he said,
"The bard's nose rag. A new art colour for our Irish poets. Snot green. You can almost taste it, can't you?"
He mounted to the parapet again and gazed out over Dublin Bay, his fair oak-pale hair stirring slightly.
"God," he said quietly, "isn't the sea what Algy calls it? A grey, sweet mother. The snot-green sea, the scrotum-tightening sea. Epi oinopa ponton. Ah, Daedalus, the Greeks, I must teach you. You must read them in the original. Thalata, thalata, she is our great sweet mother. Come and look."
Stephen stood up and went over to the parapet. Leaning on it, he looked down on the water and on the mailboat clearing the harbour mouth of Kingstown.
"Our mighty mother," Buck Mulligan said.
He turned abruptly his great searching eyes from the sea to Stephen's face.
"The aunt thinks you killed your mother," he said. "That's why she won't let me have anything to do with you."
"Someone killed her," Stephen said gloomily.
"You could have knelt down, damn it, Kinch, when your dying mother asked you," Buck Mulligan said. "I'm Hyperborean as much as you, but to think of your mother begging you with her last breath to kneel down and pray for her, and you refused. There's something sinister in you."
He broke off and lathered again, lightly, his father's cheek. A tolerant smile curled his lips.
"But a lovely mummer," he murmured to himself. "Kinch, the loveliest mummer of them all."
He shaved evenly and with care, in silence, seriously. Stephen, an elbow rested on the jagged granite, leaned his palm against his brow and gazed at the fraying edge of his shiny black coat sleeve. Pain, that was not yet the pain of love, fretted his heart. Silently in a dream, she had come to him after her death, her wasted body within its loose brown grave clothes giving off an odour of wax and rosewood, her breath that had bent upon him, mute, reproachful, a faint odour of wetted ashes. Across the threadbare cuff-edge, he saw the sea, hailed as a great sweet mother by the well-fed voice beside him. The ring of bay and skyline held a dull green mass of liquid. A bowl of white china had stood beside her deathbed, holding the green sluggish bile which she had torn up from her rotting liver by fits of loud groaning vomiting. Buck Mulligan wiped again his razor blade.
"Ah, poor dog's body," he said in a kind voice. "I must give you a shirt and a few nose rags. How are the second-hand breeks?"
"They fit well enough," Stephen answered. Buck Mulligan attacked the hollow beneath his underlip.
"The mockery of it," he said contentedly. "Second leg they should be. God knows what poxy bells he left them off. I've a lovely pair with a hair stripe, grey. You look spiffing in them. I'm not joking, Kinch. You look damn well when you're dressed."
"Thanks," Stephen said. "I can't wear them if they're grey."
"He can't wear them," Buck Mulligan told his face in the mirror. "Etiquette is etiquette. He kills his mother, but he can't wear grey trousers."
He folded his razor neatly, and with stroking palps of fingers, felt the smooth skin. Stephen turned his gaze from the sea and to the plump face with its smoke-blue, mobile eyes.
"That fella I was with in the ship last night," said Buck Mulligan, "says you have GPI. He's up in Dottyville with Connolly Norman. General paralysis of the insane."
He swept the mirror a half-circle in the air to flash the tidings abroad in sunlight, now radiant on the sea. His curling, shaven lips laughed, and the edges of his white, glittering teeth. Laughter seized all his strong, well-knit trunk.
"Look at yourself," he said. "You dreadful bard!"
Stephen bent forward and peered at the mirror held out to him, cleft by a crooked crack, hair on end. "As he and others see me, who chose this face for me, this dog's body, to rid of vermin? It asks me, too."
"I pinched it out of the skivvy's room," Buck Mulligan said. "It does her all right. The aunt always keeps plain-looking servants for Malachy. Lead him not into temptation. And her name is Ursula."
Laughing again, he brought the mirror away from Stephen's peering eyes.
"The rage of Caliban at not seeing his face in a mirror," he he said. "If Wilde were only alive to see you!"
Drawing back and pointing, Stephen said with bitterness, "It's a symbol of Irish art, the cracked looking-glass of a servant." Buck Mulligan suddenly linked his arm in Stephen's and walked with him round the tower, his razor and mirror clacking in the pocket where he had thrust them.
"It's not fair to tease you like that, Kinch, is it?" he said kindly. "God knows you have more spirit than any of them."
Parried again. "He fears the lancet of my art, as I fear that of his, the cold steel pen."
"Cracked looking-glass of a servant. Tell that to the Oxy chap downstairs and touch him for a guinea. He's stinking with money and thinks you're not a gentleman. His elf-fella made his tin by selling jalap to Zulus or some bloody swindle or other. God, Kinch, if you and I could only work together, we might do something for the island. Hellenize it."
Cranley's arm. His arm.
"And to think of your having to beg from these swine. I'm the only one that knows what you are. Why don't you trust me more? What have you got up your nose against me? Is it Haynes? If he makes any noise here, I'll bring down Seymour, and we give him a ragging worse than they gave Clive Kempthorpe."
Young shouts of moneyed voices in Clive Kempthorpe's rooms. Pale faces. They held their ribs with laughter, one clasping another. "Oh, I shall expire. Break the news to her gently, Aubrey. I shall die." With slit ribbons of his shirt whipping the air, he hops and hobbles round the table, with trousers down at heels, chased by Addies of Magdalen with the tailor's shears. A scared calf's face, gilded with marmalade. "I don't want to be debagged. Don't you play the giddy ox with me." Shouts from the open window. Startling evening at the quadrangle. A deaf gardener, aproned, masked with Matthew Arnold's face, pushes his mower on the somber lawn, watching narrowly the dancing motes of grass arms. To ourselves, new paganism, Omphalos. "Let him stay," Stephen said. "There's nothing wrong with him, except at night."
"Then what is it?" Buck Mulligan asked impatiently. "Cough it up, I'm quite frank with you. What have you against me now?"
They halted, looking toward the blunt cape of Bray Head that lay on the water like the snout of a sleeping whale. Stephen freed his arm quietly. "Do you wish me to tell you?" he asked.
"Yes, what is it?" Buck Mulligan answered. "I don't remember anything."
He looked in Stephen's face as he spoke. A light wind passed his brow, fanning softly his fair, uncombed hair and stirring silver points of anxiety in his eyes. Stephen, depressed by his own voice, said, "Do you remember the first day I went to your house after my mother's death?" Buck Mulligan frowned quickly and said,
"What? Where? I can't remember anything. I remember only ideas and sensations. Why? What happened in the name of God?"
"You were making tea," Stephen said, "and I went across the landing to get more hot water. Your mother and some visitor came out of the drawing room. She asked you who was in your room."
"Yes," Buck Mulligan said. "What did I say? I forget."
"You said," Stephen answered, "Oh, it's only Daedalus, whose mother is beastly dead." A flush, which made him seem younger and more engaging, rose to Buck Mulligan's cheek.
"Did I say that?"
he asked.
"Well, what harm is that?"
He shook his constraint from him, nervously.
"And what is death?" he asked. "Your mother's or yours or my own? You saw only your mother die. I see them pop off every day in the matter in Richmond and cut into tripes in the dissecting room. It's a beastly thing and nothing else. It simply doesn't matter. You wouldn't kneel down to pray for your mother on her deathbed when she asked you. Why? Because you have the cursed Jesuit strain in you, only it's injected the wrong way. To me, it's all a mockery and beastly. Her cerebral lobes are not functioning. She calls the doctor Sir Peter Teasel and picks buttercups off the quilt. Humor her till it's over. You crossed her last wish in death, and yet you sulk with me because I don't whinge like some hard mute from Lalouette's. Absurd! I suppose I did say it. I didn't mean to offend the memory of your mother."
He had spoken himself into boldness. Stephen, shielding the gaping wounds which the words had left in his heart, said very coldly, "I am not thinking of the offence to my mother."
"Of what, then?" Buck Mulligan asked.
"Of the offence to me," Stephen answered. Buck Mulligan swung round on his heel.
"Oh, an impossible person!" he exclaimed.
He walked off quickly round the parapet. Stephen stood at his post, gazing over the calm sea towards the headland. Sea and headland now grew dim. Pulses were beating in his eyes, veiling their sight, and he felt the fever of his cheeks. A voice within the tower called loudly,
"Are you up there, Mulligan?"
"I'm coming,"
Buck Mulligan answered.
He turned towards Stephen and said, "Look at the sea. What does it care about offences? Chuck Loyola Kinch and come on down. The Sassenach wants his morning rushers."
His head halted again for a moment at the top of the staircase, level with the roof.
"Don't mope over it all day," he said. "I'm inconsequent. Give up the moody brooding."
His head vanished, but the drone of his descending voice boomed out of the stairhead.
"And no more turn aside and brood upon love's bitter mystery, for Fergist rules the brazen cars."
Wood shadows floated silently by through the morning peace from the stairhead, seaward, where he gazed. Inshore and farther out, the mirror of water whitened, spurned by light-shod hurrying feet. White breast of the dim sea, the twining stresses two by two. A hand plucking the harp strings, merging their twining chords. Wave-white wedded words, shimmering on the dim tide. A cloud began to cover the sun slowly, shadowing the bay in deeper green. It lay behind him, a bowl of bitter waters. Fergus's song. I sang it alone in the house, holding down the long, dark chords. Her door was open. She wanted to hear my music. Silent with awe and pity, I went to her bedside. She was crying in her wretched bed. "For those words, Stephen, love's bitter mystery." "Where now?" Her secrets, old feather fans, tassel dance cards powdered with musk, a gourd of amber beads in her locked drawer. A birdcage hung in the sunny window of her house when she was a girl. She heard old Royce sing in the pantomime of Turk of the Terrible and laughed with others when he sang,
"I am the boy that can enjoy invisibility."
Phantasmal mirth folded away, musk-perfumed, and no more turn aside and brood. Folded away in the memory of nature with her toys. Memories beset his brooding brain. Her glass of water from the kitchen tap when she'd approached the sacrament. A cored apple filled with brown sugar roasting for her at the hob on a dark autumn evening. Her shapely fingernails reddened by the blood of squashed lice from the children's shirts. In a dream, silently, she had come to him, her wasted body within its loose grave clothes giving off an odor of wax and rosewood. Her breath bent over him with mute, secret words, a faint odor of wetted ashes. Her glazing eyes staring out of death to shake and bend my soul on me alone. The ghost candle to light her agony, ghostly light on the tortured face. Her hoarse, loud breath rattling in horror while all prayed on their knees, her eyes on me to strike me down. Deliata rutilantinum te confessorum turcum circumdet, jubilantium te virginum chorus excipiat.
Ghoul, chewer of corpses. No, mother, let me be and let me live.
Kinch ahoy!
Buck Mulligan's voice sang from within the tower. It came nearer up the staircase, calling again. Stephen, still trembling at his soul's cry, heard warm, running sunlight, and in the air behind him, friendly words.
"Daedalus, come down like a good mosey. Breakfast is ready. Haynes is apologizing for waking us last night. It's all right."
"I'm coming," Stephen said, turning.
"Do, for Jesus' sake," Buck Mulligan said. "For my sake and for all our sakes."
His head disappeared and reappeared.
"I told him your symbol of Irish art. He says it's very clever. Touch him for a quid, will you? A guinea, I mean."
"I get paid this morning," Stephen said.
"The school kip," Buck Mulligan said. "How much? 4 quid? Lend us one."
"If you want it," Stephen said.
"4 shining sovereigns," Buck Mulligan cried with delight. "We'll have a glorious drunk to astonish the druidy druids. Four omnipotent sovereigns!"
He flung up his hands and tramped down the stone stairs, singing out of tune with a Cockney accent.
"Oh, won't we have a merry time, drinking whiskey, beer and wine, on Coronation, Coronation Day. Oh, won't we have a merry time on Coronation Day."
Warm sunshine, merrying over the sea. The nickel shaving bowl shone, forgotten, on the parapet. Why should I bring it down? I'll leave it there all day. Forgotten friendship. He went over to it, held it in his hands a while, feeling its coolness, smelling the clammy slobber of the lather in which the brush was stuck. So I carried the boat of incense then at Clongowes. I am another now, and yet the same. A servant, too. A server of a servant. In the gloomy domed living room of the tower, Buck Mulligan's gowned form moved briskly about the hearth to and fro, hiding and revealing its yellow glow. Two shafts of soft daylight fell across the flagged floor from the high barbicans, and at the meeting of their rays a cloud of coal smoke and fumes of fried grease floated, turning.
"We'll be choked," Buck Mulligan said. "Haines, open that door, will you?"
Stephen laid the shaving bowl on the locker. A tall figure rose from the hammock where it had been sitting, went to the doorway, and pulled open the inner doors.
"Have you the key?"
a voice asked.
"Dedalus has it,"
Buck Mulligan said.
"Janey Mac, I'm choked!"
He howled, without looking up from the fire.
"Kinch!"
"It's in the lock," Stephen said, coming forward. The key scraped round harshly twice, and when the heavy door had been set ajar, welcome light and bright air entered. Haines stood at the doorway, looking out. Stephen hailed his upended valise to the table and sat down to wait. Buck Mulligan tossed the fry onto the dish beside him. Then he carried the dish and a large teapot over to the table, set them down heavily, and sighed with relief.
"I'm melting," he said, as the candle remarked when, but hush, not a word more on that subject.
"Kinch, wake up, bread, butter, honey. Haines, come in. The grub is ready. Bless us, O Lord, and these thy gifts. Where's the sugar? Ah, Jay, there's no milk."
Stephen fetched the loaf and the pot of honey and the butter cooler from the locker. Buck Mulligan sat down in a sudden pet.
"What sort of a kip is this?" he said.
"I told her to come after 8.
"We can drink it black," Stephen said. "There's a lemon in the locker."
"Oh, damn you and your Paris fads," Buck Mulligan said. "I want Sandy Cove milk."
Haines came in from the doorway and said quietly, "That woman is coming up with the milk."
"The blessings of God on you,"
Buck Mulligan cried, jumping up from his chair.
"Sit down, pour out the tea there. The sugar is in the bike. Here, I can't go fumbling at the damned eggs."
He hacked through the fry on the dish and slapped it out on 3 plates, saying,
"In nomine Patris, et Filii, et Spiritus Sancti."
Haines sat down to pour out the tea.
"I'm giving you 2 lamps each," he said. "But I say, Mulligan, you do make strong tea, don't you?"
Buck Mulligan, hewing thick slices from the loaf, said in an old woman's wheedling voice,
"When I makes tay, as old Mother Grogan said, and when I makes water."
"By Jove, it is tea," Haines said.
Buck Mulligan went on hewing and wheedling.
"So I do, Mrs. Cahill," says she. "Be God, ma'am," said Mrs. Cahill, "God send you don't make them in the one pot."
He lunged towards his messmates in turn, a thick slice of bread impaled on his knife.
"That's folk," he said very earnestly, "for your book, Haines. 5 lines of text and 10 pages of notes about the folk and the fish gods of Dundrum, printed by the weird sisters in the year of the big wind."
He turned to Stephen and asked in a fine, puzzled voice, lifting his brows,
"Can you recall, brother, is Mother Grogan's tea and mortar pot spoken of in the Mabinogion, or is it in the Upanishads?"
"I doubt it," said Stephen gravely.
"Do you now?" Buck Mulligan said in the same tone. "Your reasons, pray."
"I fancy," Stephen said as he ate, "it did not exist in or out of the Mabinogion. Mother Grogan was, one imagines, a kinswoman of Mary Ann." Buck Mulligan's face smiled with delight.
"Charming," he said, in a finical sweet voice, showing his white teeth and blinking his eyes pleasantly. "Do you think she was? Quite charming."
Then suddenly, overclouding all his features, he growled in a hoarsened, rasping voice as he hewed again vigorously at the loaf.
For old Mary Ann, she doesn't care a damn, but hissing up her petticoats.
He crammed his mouth with fry, and munched, and droned. The doorway was darkened by an entering form.
The milk, sir.
Come in, ma'am, Mulligan said. Kinch, get the jug.
An old woman came forward and stood by Stephen's elbow.
That's a lovely morning, sir, she said. Glory be to God.
To whom?
Mulligan said, glancing at her.
Ah, to be sure.
Stephen reached back and took the milk jug from the locker. The islanders, Mulligan said to Haines casually, speak frequently of the collector of prepuces.
How much, sir?
Asked the old woman.
A quart,
Stephen said. He watched her pour into the measure and thence into the jug, rich white milk, not hers.
Old shrunken paps.
She poured again a measureful and a tilly. Old and secret she had entered from a mourning world, maybe a messenger. She praised the goodness of the milk, pouring it out.
Crouching by a patient cow at daybreak in the lush field, a witch on her toadstool, her wrinkled fingers quick at the squirting dugs. They lowed about her whom they knew, dew-silky cattle, silk of the kine, and poor old woman, names given her in old times. A wandering crone, lowly form of an immortal, serving her conqueror and her gay betrayer, their common cook-queen, a messenger from the secret morning. To serve or to upbraid, whether he could not tell, but scorned to beg her favour.
"It is indeed, ma'am," Buck Mulligan said, pouring milk into their cups.
"Taste it, sir,"
she said. He drank at her bidding.
"If we could only live on good food like that," he said to her somewhat loudly, "we wouldn't have the country full of rotten teeth and rotten guts, living in a bog swamp, eating cheap food, and the streets paved with dust, horse dung, and consumptive spits."
"Are you a medical student, sir?"
the old woman asked.
"I am, ma'am," Buck Mulligan answered.
Stephen listened in scornful silence. She bows her old head to a voice that speaks to her loudly, her bone-setter, her medicine-man. Me, she slights, to the voice that will shrive and oil for the grave all there is of her but her woman's unclean loins, of man's flesh made not in God's likeness, the serpent's prey, and to the loud voice that now bids her be silent with wondering, unsteady eyes.
"Do you understand what he says?" Stephen asked her. "Is it French you're talking, sir?"
the old woman said to Haines. Haines spoke to her again, a longer speech, confidently.
"Irish," Buck Mulligan said. "Is there Gaelic on you?"
"I thought it was Irish," she said, "by the sound of it. Are you from the West, sir?" "I'm an Englishman," Haines answered.
"He's English," Buck Mulligan said, "and he thinks we ought to speak Irish in Ireland."
"Sure we ought to," the old woman said, "and I'm ashamed I don't speak the language myself. I'm told it's a grand language by them that knows."
"Grand is no name for it," said Buck Mulligan. "Wonderful entirely. Fill out some more tea, Kinch. Would you like a cup, ma'am?"
"No, thank you, sir,"
the old woman said, slipping the ring of the milk can on her forearm and about to go. Haines said to her,
"Have you your bill? We better pay him, Mulligan, hadn't we?"
Stephen filled the three cups.
"Bill, sir," she said, halting. "Well, it's 7 mornings, a pint at tuppence, 7 twos is a shilling, and 2 pence over, and these 3 mornings, a quart at 4 pence is 3/4 a shilling, and 1 and 2 is 2 and 2, sir."
Buck Mulligan sighed, and having filled his mouth with a crust thickly buttered on both sides, stretched forth his legs and began to search his trouser pockets.
"Pay up and look pleasant," Haines said to him, smiling.
Stephen filled a third cup, a spoonful of tea, colouring faintly the thick, rich milk. Buck Mulligan brought up a florin, twisted it round in his fingers, and cried,
"A miracle!"
He passed it along the table towards the old woman, saying, "Ask nothing more of me, sweet. All I can give you, I give." Stephen laid the coin in her uneager hand.
"We'll owe tuppence," he said. "Time enough, sir," she said, taking the coin. "Time enough. Good morning, sir."
She curtsied and went out, followed by Buck Mulligan's tender chant.
"Heart of my heart, were it more, more would be laid at your feet."
He turned to Stephen and said, "Seriously, Dedalus, I'm stony. Hurry out to your school kip and bring us back some money. Today the bards must drink and junket. Ireland expects that every man this day will do his duty."
"That reminds me," Haines said, rising, "that I have to visit your national library today."
"Our swim first," Buck Mulligan said.
He turned to Stephen and asked blandly, "Is this the day for your monthly wash, Kinch?" Then he said to Haines, "The unclean bard makes a point of washing once a month." "All Ireland is washed by the Gulf Stream," Stephen said, as he let honey trickle over a slice of the loaf. Haines, from the corner where he was knotting easily a scarf about the loose collar of his tennis shirt, spoke, "I intend to make a collection of your sayings, if you will let me."
"Speaking to me, they wash and tub and scrub. Agenbite of inwit. Conscience. Yet, here's a spot.
That one about the cracked looking-glass of a servant being the symbol of Irish art is deuced good." Buck Mulligan kicked Stephen's foot under the table and said with warmth of tone,
"Wait till you hear him on Hamlet, Haines."
"Well, I mean it," Haines said, still speaking to Stephen. "I was just thinking of it when that poor old creature came in."
"Would I make money by it?" Stephen asked.
Haines laughed, and as he took his soft grey hat from the holdfast of the hammock, said, "I don't know, I'm sure." He strolled out of the doorway. Buck Mulligan bent across to Stephen and said with coarse vigour,
"You put your hoof in it now. What did you say that for?"
"Well," Stephen said, "the problem is to get money. From whom? From the milkwoman or from him? It's a toss-up, I think."
"I blow him out about you," Buck Mulligan said, "and then you come along with your lousy leer and your gloomy Jesuit jibes."
"I see little hope," Stephen said, "from her or from him." Buck Mulligan sighed tragically and laid his hand on Stephen's arm.
"From me, Kinch," he said.
In a suddenly changed tone, he added, "To tell you the God's truth, I think you're right. Damn all else they're good for. Why don't you play them as I do? To hell with them all. Let us get out of the kip."
He stood up, gravely ungirdled and disrobed himself of his gown, saying resignedly,
"Mulligan is stripped of his garments."
He emptied his pockets onto the table.
"There's your snot rag," he said.
And putting on a stiff collar and rebellious tie, he spoke to them, chiding them, and to his dangling watch chain. His hands plunged and rummaged in his trunk while he called for a clean handkerchief. Agenbite of inwit.
"God will simply have to dress the character. I want puce gloves and green boots. Contradiction. Do I contradict myself? Very well, then, I contradict myself. Mercurial Malachy."
A limp black missile flew out of his talking hands.
"And there's your Latin Quarter hat," he said.
Stephen picked it up and put it on. Haines called to them from the doorway.
"Are you coming, you fellows?"
"I'm ready,"
Buck Mulligan answered, going towards the door.
"Come out, Kinch. You've eaten all we left, I suppose."
Resigned, he passed out with grave words and gait, saying, well nigh with sorrow,
"And going forth he met Butterly."
Stephen, taking his ashplant from his leaning place, followed them out, and as they went down the ladder, pulled to the slow iron door and locked it. He put the huge key in his inner pocket. At the foot of the ladder, Buck Mulligan asked,
"Did you bring the key?"
"I have it," Stephen said, preceding them. He walked on. Behind him, he heard Buck Mulligan club with his heavy bath towel the leader shoots of ferns or grasses.
"Down, sir! How dare you, sir?"
Haines asked, "Do you pay rent for this tower?"
£12,
Buck Mulligan said. "To the Secretary of State for War," Stephen added, over his shoulder. They halted while Haines surveyed the tower and said at last, "Rather bleak in winter time, I should say. Martello, you call it?"
"Billy Pitt had them built," Buck Mulligan said, "when the French were on the sea. But ours is the Omphalos."
"What is your idea of Hamlet?" Haines asked Stephen.
"No, no," Buck Mulligan shouted in pain. "I'm not equal to Thomas Aquinas and the 55 reasons he's made to prop it up. Wait till I have a few pints in me first."
He turned to Stephen, saying, as he pulled down neatly the peaks of his primrose waistcoat,
"You couldn't manage it under 3 points, Kinch, could you?"
"It has waited so long," Stephen said listlessly. "It can wait longer." "You pique my curiosity," Haines said amiably. "Is it some paradox?"
"Pooh," Buck Mulligan said. "We've grown out of wild and paradoxes. It's quite simple. He proves by algebra that Hamlet's grandson is Shakespeare's grandfather and that he himself is the ghost of his own father."
"What?"
Haines said, beginning to point at Stephen.
"He himself?"
Buck Mulligan slung his towel stolewise round his neck and, bending in loose laughter, said to Stephen's ear,
"Oh, shade of Kinch the Elder, Japheth in search of a father."
"We're always tired in the morning," Stephen said to Haines, "and it is rather long to tell." Buck Mulligan, walking forward again, raised his hands.
"The sacred pint alone can unbind the tongue of Daedalus," he said.
"I mean to say," Haines explained to Stephen as they followed, "this tower and these cliffs here remind me somehow of Elsinore, that beetles o'er his base into the sea, isn't it?"
Buck Mulligan turned suddenly for an instant towards Stephen, but did not speak. In the bright, silent instant, Stephen saw his own image in cheap, dusty mourning, between their gay attires.
"It's a wonderful tale," Haines said, bringing them to halt again.
Eyes pale as the sea, the wind had freshened, paler, firm, and prudent. The sea's ruler. He gazed southward over the bay, empty save for the smoke plume of the mailboat, vague on the bright skyline, and a sail tacking by the Muglins.
"I read a theological interpretation of it somewhere," he said, bemused. "The Father and the Son idea. The Son striving to be atoned with the Father."
Buck Mulligan at once put on a blithe, broadly smiling face. He looked at them, his well-shaped mouth open happily, his eyes, from which he had suddenly withdrawn all shrewd sense, blinking with mad gaiety. He moved a doll's head to and fro, the brims of his Panama hat quivering, and began to chant in a quiet, happy, foolish voice.
"I'm the queerest young fella that ever you heard. My mother's a Jew, my father's a bird. With Joseph the joiner I cannot agree, for here's two disciples and Calvary."
He held up a forefinger of warning.
"If anyone thinks that I am a divine, he'll get no free drinks when I'm making the wine, but have to drink water and wish it were plain that I make when the wine becomes water again."
He tugged swiftly at Stephen's ash plant in farewell, and running forward to the brow of the cliff, fluttered his hands at his sides like fins or wings of one about to rise in the air, and chanted,
"Goodbye now, goodbye, write down all I said, and tell Tom, Dick, and Harry I rose from the dead. What's bred in the bone cannot fail me to fly, and Olivet's breezy, goodbye now, goodbye."
He capered before them down towards the 40-foot hole, fluttering his wing-like hands, leaping nimbly, Mercury's hat quivering in the fresh wind that bore back to them his brief, bird-like cries. Haines, who had been laughing guardedly, walked on beside Stephen and said, "We oughtn't to laugh, I suppose. He's rather blasphemous. I'm not a believer myself, that is to say. Still, his gaiety takes the harm out of it somehow, doesn't it? What did he call it? Joseph the Joiner?"
"The Ballad of Joking Jesus," Stephen answered.
"Oh," Haines said, "you've heard it before."
3 times a day after meals," Stephen said dryly.
"You're not a believer, are you?" Haines asked. "I mean a believer in the narrow sense of the word. Creation from nothing and miracles and a personal God."
"There's only one sense of the word, it seems to me," Stephen said.
Haines stopped to take out a smooth silver case in which twinkled a green stone. He sprang it open with his thumb and offered it.
"Thank you," Stephen said, taking a cigarette.
Haines helped himself and snapped the case too. He put it back in his side pocket and took from his waistcoat pocket a nickel tinderbox, sprang it open too, and having lit his cigarette, held the flaming spunk toward Stephen in the shell of his hands.
"Yes, of course," he said, as they went on again. "Either you believe or you don't, isn't it? Personally, I couldn't stomach the idea of a personal God. You don't stand for that, I suppose."
"You behold in me," Stephen said with grim displeasure, "a horrible example of free thought."
He walked on, waiting to be spoken to, trailing his ash plant by his side. Its ferrule followed lightly on the path, squealing at his heels.
"My familiar, after me, calling Stephen." A wavering line along the path. "They will walk on it tonight, coming here in the dark. He wants that key. It's mine. I paid the rent. Now I eat his salt bread. Give him the key, too. All. He will ask for it." That was in his eyes.
"After all," Haines began.
Stephen turned and saw that the cold gaze which had measured him was not all unkind.
"After all, I should think you are able to free yourself. You are your own master, it seems to me."
"I'm the servant of 2 masters, Stephen said. "An English and an Italian."
"Italian?" Haines said.
"A crazy queen, old and jealous, kneel down before me."
"And a third," Stephen said, "there is, who wants me for odd jobs." "Italian?" Haines said again. "What do you mean?"
"The Imperial British State,"
Stephen answered, his colour rising, and the Holy Roman Catholic and Apostolic Church. Haines detached from his underlip some fibres of tobacco before he spoke.
I can quite understand that, he said calmly. An Irishman must think like that, I dare say. We feel in England that we have treated you rather unfairly. It seems history is to blame.
The proud potent titles clanged over Stephen's memory, the triumph of their brazen bells, et unam sanctam catholicam, et apostolicam ecclesiam. The slow growth and change of rite and dogma, like his own rare thoughts, a chemistry of stars. Symbol of the apostles in the Mass for Pope Marcellus. The voices blended, singing alone, loud in affirmation. And behind their chant, the vigilant angel of the church militant disarmed and menaced her heresiarchs. A horde of heresies fleeing with mitres awry. Photius and a brood of mockers of whom Mulligan was one. An Arius, warring his life long upon the consubstantiality of the Son with the Father. And Valentine, spurning Christ's terrene body. And the subtle African heresiarch, Sabellius, who held that the Father was himself his own son. Words Mulligan had spoken a moment since in mockery to the stranger. Idle mockery. The void awaits surely all them that weave the wind. A menace, a disarming, and a worsting from those embattled angels of the church, Michael's host, who defend her ever in the hour of conflict with their lances and their shields. Hear, hear, prolonged applause. Zut, nom de Dieu.
Of course, I'm a Britisher, Haines' voice said, and I feel as one. I don't want to see my country fall into the hands of German Jews either. That's our national problem, I'm afraid, just now.
Two men stood at the verge of the cliff, watching. Businessman, boatman.
She's making for Bullock Harbour.
The boatman nodded towards the north of the bay with some disdain.
There's 5 fathoms out there, he said. It'll be swept up that way when the tide comes in about 1. It's 9 days today.
The man that was drowned. A sail veering about the blank bay, waiting for a swollen bundle to bob up, roll over to the sun, a puffy face, salt white. Here I am. They followed the winding path down to the creek. Buck Mulligan stood on stone, in shirt sleeves, his unclipped tie rippling over his shoulder. A young man, clinging to a spur of rock near him, moved slowly frogwise, his green legs in the deep jelly of the water.
"Is the brother witch of Malachy?"
"Down in Westmead with the Bannons."
"Still there? I got a card from Bannon. Says he found a sweet young thing down there. Photo girl, he calls her."
"Snapshot, eh? Brief exposure."
Buck Mulligan sat down to unlace his boots. An elderly man shot up near the spur of rocks, a blowing red face. He scrambled up by the stones, water glistening on his pate, and on its garland of grey hair, water rilling over his chest and paunch and spilling jets out of his black sagging loincloth. Buck Mulligan made way for him to scramble past, and glancing at Haines and Stephen, crossed himself piously with his thumbnail at brow and lips and breastbone.
"Seymour's back in town," the young man said, grasping again his spur of rock. "Chuck medicine and going in for the army."
"I'll go to God," Buck Mulligan said.
"Going over next week to stew. You know that Red Carlisle girl, Lily?"
"Yes."
"Spooning with him last night on the pier. The father is rotto with money."
"Is she up the pole?"
"Better ask Seymour that."
"Seymour, a bleeding officer,"
Buck Mulligan said. He nodded to himself as he drew off his trousers and stood up, saying tritely,
"Red-headed women buck like goats."
He broke off in alarm, feeling his side under his flapping shirt.
"My 12th rib is gone," he cried. "I'm the Übermensch, Toothless Kinch and I, the Superman."
He struggled out of his shirt and flung it behind him to where his clothes lay.
"Are you going in here, Malachy?"
"Yes, make room in the bed."
The young man shoved himself backwards through the water and reached the middle of the creek in 2 long, clean strokes. Haines sat down on a stone, smoking.
"Are you not coming in?"
Buck Mulligan asked.
"Later on," Haines said. "Not on my breakfast."
Stephen turned away.
"I'm going, Mulligan," he said.
"Give us that key, Kinch,"
Buck Mulligan said,
"to keep my chemise flat."
Stephen handed him the key. Buck Mulligan laid it across his heaped clothes.
"And tuppence," he said, "for a pint. Throw it there."
Stephen threw 2 pennies on the soft heap. Dressing, undressing. Buck Mulligan, erect, with joined hands before him, said solemnly, "He who stealeth from the poor lendeth to the Lord. Thus spake Zarathustra." His plump body plunged. "We'll see you again," Haines said, turning, as Stephen walked up the path, and smiling at Wild Irish. Horn of a bull, hoof of a horse, smile of a Saxon.
"The ship!" Buck Mulligan cried. "Half 12!"
"Good," Stephen said. He walked along the upward curving path. Liliata rutilantium, terma circumdet, jubilantium te virginum. The priest's grey nimbus in a niche where he dressed discreetly. "I will not sleep here tonight. Home also I cannot go." A voice, sweet-toned and sustained, called to him from the sea. Turning the curve, he waved his hand. It called again. A sleek, brown head, a seal's, far out on the water, round. "Usurper." "You, Cochrane. What's did he send for him?"
"Tarentum, sir."
"Very good. Well?"
"There was a battle, sir."
"Very good. Where?"
The boy's blank face asked the blank window. Fable by the daughters of memory. And yet it was in some way, if not as memory fabled it. A phrase, then, of impatience, thud of Blake's wings of excess. I hear the rune of old space, shattered glass and toppling masonry. And time one livid final flame. What's left us then?
"I forget the place, sir. 279 B.C.
"Asculum," Stephen said, glancing at the name and date in the Gorse Guard book.
"Yes, sir. And he said, another victory like that and we are done for."
That phrase the world had remembered. A dull ease of the mind. From a hill above a corpse-strewn plain, a general speaking to his officers leaned upon his spear. Any general to any officers. They lend ear.
"You, Armstrong," Stephen said. "What was the end of Pyrrhus?"
"End of Pyrrhus, sir? I know, sir. Ask me, sir,"
Common said. "Wait, you, Armstrong. Do you know anything about Pyrrhus?"
A bag of fig rolls lay snugly in Armstrong's satchel. He curled them between his palms at whiles and swallowed them softly. Crumbs adhered to the tissues of his lips. A sweetened boy's breath. Well-off people, proud that their eldest son was in the Navy. Vico Road, Dorky.
"Pyrrhus, sir. Pyrrhus, a peer."
All laughed. Mirthless, high, malicious laughter. Armstrong looked round at his classmates, silly glee in profile. In a moment they will laugh more loudly, aware of my lack of rule and of the fees their papas pay.
"Tell me now," Stephen said, poking the boy's shoulder with the book, "what is a peer?"
"A pier, sir," Armstrong said. "A thing out in the waves, a kind of bridge. Kingstown pier, sir."
Some laughed again, mirthless but with meaning. Two on the back bench whispered. Yes, they knew, had never learned, nor ever been innocent, all. With envy, he watched their faces. Edith, Ethel, Gertie, Lily. Their likes, their breaths too, sweetened with tea and jam, their bracelets tittering in the struggle.
"Kingstown Pier," Stephen said. "Yes, a disappointed bridge."
The words troubled their gaze.
"How, sir?"
Common asked.
"A bridge is across a river."
For Haines's chapbook, no one here to hear. Tonight deftly amid wild drink and talk to pierce the polished mail of his mind. What then? A jester at the court of his master, indulged and disesteemed, winning a clement master's praise? Why had they chosen all that part? Not only for the smooth caress. For them, too, history was a tale like any other, too often heard. Their land, a pawn shop. Had Pyrrhus not fallen by Abeldam's hand in Argos, or Julius Caesar not been knifed to death? They are not to be thought away. Time has branded them, and fettered, they are lodged in the room of the infinite possibilities they have ousted. But can those have been possible, seeing that they never were? Or was that only possible which came to pass? Weave, weaver of the wind.
Tells a story, sir. Oh, dear, sir, a ghost story.
Where do you begin in this? Stephen asked, opening another book.
Weep no more,
Comyn said.
Go on, then, Talbot.
And the history, sir.
After, Stephen said.
Go on, Talbot.
A swarthy boy opened a book and propped it nimbly under the breastwork of a satchel. He recited jerks of verse with odd glances at the text.
Weep no more, woeful shepherd, weep no more, for Lycidas, your sorrow is not dead, sunk though he be beneath the watery floor.
It must be a movement, then, an actuality of the possible as possible. Aristotle's phrase formed itself within the gabble verses and floated out into the studious silence of the library of St. Genevieve, where he had read Sheltered from the Sin of Paris, night by night. By his elbow, a delicate Siamese conned a handbook of strategy. Fed and feeding brains about me, under glow lamps impaled, with faintly beating feelers. And in my mind's darkness, a sloth of the underworld, reluctant, shy of brightness, shifting her dragon scaly folds. Thought is the thought of thought. Tranquil brightness. The soul is, in a manner, all that is. The soul is the form of forms. Tranquility, sudden, vast, candescent, form of forms. Talbot repeated,
Through the dear might of him that walked the waves, through the dear might...
Turn over, Stephen said quietly. I don't see anything.
What, sir?
Talbot asked simply, bending forward. His hand turned the page over. He leaned back and went on again, having just remembered.
Of him that walked the waves.
Here also, over these craven hearts, his shadow lies, and on the scoffer's heart and lips, and on mine. It lies upon their eager faces, who offered him a coin of the tribute. To Caesar what is Caesar's, to God what is God's. A long look from dark eyes, a riddling sentence to be woven and woven on the church's looms. Aye. Riddle me, Randy Rowe. My father gave me seeds to sow. Talbot slid his closed book into his satchel.
Have I heard all? Stephen asked.
Yes, sir. Hockey at 10, sir. Half day, sir. Thursday.
Who can answer a riddle? Stephen asked.
They bundled their books away, pencils clacking, pages rustling. Crowding together, they strapped and buckled their satchels, all gabbling gaily.
A riddle, sir. Ask me, sir. Oh, ask me, sir. A hard one, sir.
This is the riddle, Stephen said. The cock crew, the sky was blue, the bells in heaven were striking 11, 'tis time for this poor soul to go to heaven.
What is that? What, sir? Again, sir, we didn't hear.
Their eyes grew bigger as the lines were repeated. After a silence, Cochrane said,
What is it, sir? We give it up.
Stephen, his throat itching, answered,
The fox burying his grandmother under a holly bush.
He stood up and gave a shout of nervous laughter, to which their cries echoed dismay. A stick struck the door, and a voice in the corridor called,
Hockey!
They broke asunder, sidling out of their benches, leaping them. Quickly they were gone, and from the lumber room came the rattle of sticks and clamour of their boots and tongues. Sergeant, who alone had lingered, came forward slowly, showing an open copybook. His tangled hair and scraggy neck gave witness of unreadiness, and through his misty glasses weak eyes looked up, pleading. On his cheek, dull and bloodless, a soft stain of ink lay, date-shaped, recent, and damp as a snail's bed. He held out his copybook. The word Sums was written on the headline. Beneath were sloping figures, and at the foot a crooked signature with blind loops and a blot. Cyril Sargent, his name and seal.
Mr. Deasy told me to write them out all again, he said, and show them to you, sir.
Stephen touched the edges of the book. Futility. Do you understand how to do them now? He asked.
Numbers 11 to 15, Sergeant answered. Mr. Deasy said I was to copy them off the board, sir.
Can you do them yourself? Stephen asked.
No, sir.
Ugly and futile. Lean neck and tangled hair and a stain of ink. A snail's bed. Yet someone had loved him, borne him in her arms and in her heart. But for her the race of the world would have trampled him underfoot, a squashed, boneless snail. She had loved his weak, watery blood, drained from her own. Was that then real? The only true thing in life? His mother's prostrate body, the fiery Columbanus and holy zeal bestrode. She was no more. The trembling skeleton of a twig burnt in the fire, an odor of rosewood and wetted ashes. She had saved him from being trampled underfoot and had gone, scarcely having been. A poor soul gone to heaven. And on a heath beneath winking stars, a fox, red, reek of rapine in his fur, with merciless bright eyes scraped in the earth, listened, scraped up the earth, listened, scraped, and scraped. Sitting at his side, Stephen solved out the problem. He proves by algebra that Shakespeare's ghost is Hamlet's grandfather. Sergeant peered askance through his slanted glasses. Hockey sticks rattled in the lumber room, the hollow knock of a ball and calls from the field. Across the page, the symbols moved in grave Maurice, in the mummery of their letters, wearing quaint caps of squares and cubes. Give hands, traverse, bow to partner, so. Imps of fancy of the Moors. Gone too from the world, Averroes and Moses Maimonides. Dark men in mien and movement, flashing in their mocking mirrors the obscure soul of the world, a darkness shining in brightness which brightness could not comprehend.
Do you understand now? Can you work the second for yourself?
Yes, sir.
In long shady strokes, Sergeant copied the data, waiting always for a word of help. His hand moved faithfully the unsteady symbols, a faint hue of shame flickering behind his dull skin. Amor matris, subjective and objective genitive. With her weak blood and whey-sour milk, she had fed him and hid from sight of others his swaddling bands. Like him was I. These sloping shoulders, this gracelessness. My childhood bends beside me. Too far for me to lay a hand there once or lightly. Mine is far and his secret as our eyes. Secrets, silent, stony, sit in the dark palaces of both our hearts. Secrets weary of their tyranny. Tyrants willing to be dethroned. The sum was done.
It was very simple, Stephen said as he stood up. Yes, sir. Thanks,
Sergeant answered. He dried the page with a sheet of thin blotting paper and carried his copybook back to his desk.
You'd better get your stick and go out to the others, Stephen said, as he followed towards the door the boy's graceless form.
Yes, sir.
In the corridor, his name was heard, called from the playfield.
Sergeant!
Run on, Stephen said. Mr. Deasy is calling you. He stood in the porch and watched the laggard hurry towards the scrappy field where sharp voices were in strife. They were sorted in teams, and Mr. Deasy came stepping over wisps of grass with gaitered feet. When he had reached the schoolhouse, voices again contending called to him. He turned his angry white moustache.
"What is it now?"
he cried continually without listening.
"Cochrane and Halliday are on the same side, sir,"
Stephen cried.
"Will you wait in my study for a moment?" Mr. Deasy said, "till I restore order here."
And as he stepped fussily back across the field, his old man's voice cried sternly,
"What's the matter? What is it now?"
Their sharp voices cried about him on all sides, their many forms closed round him, the garish sunshine bleaching the honey of his ill-dyed head. Stale, smoky air hung in the study, with the smell of drab, abraded leather of its chairs. As on the first day he bargained with me here, as it was in the beginning, is now. On the sideboard, the tray of Stuart coins, base treasure of a bog, and ever shall be. And snug in their spoon case of purple plush, faded,
the 12 apostles having preached to all the Gentiles. World without end. A hasty step over the stone porch and in the corridor. Blowing out his rare moustache, Mr. Deasy halted at the table.
"First, our little financial settlement," he said.
He brought out of his coat a pocketbook bound by a leather thong. It slapped open, and he took from it two notes, one of joined halves, and laid them carefully on the table.
"Two,"
he said, strapping and stowing his pocketbook away. And now his strong room for the gold. Stephen's embarrassed hand moved over the shells, heaped in the cold stone mortar. Whelks and money, cowries and leopard shells. And this, whorled as an emir's turban, and this, the scallop of St. James. An old pilgrim's hoard, dead treasure, hollow shells. A sovereign fell bright and new on the soft pile of the tablecloth.
"Three,"
Mr. Deasy said, turning his little savings box about in his hand.
"These are handy things to have. See, this is for sovereigns, this is for shillings, sixpences, half-crowns, and here crowns. See?"
He shot from it 2 crowns and 2 shillings.
"3, 12, he said. "I think you'll find that's right."
"Thank you, sir," Stephen said, gathering the money together with shy haste and putting it all in the pocket of his trousers.
"No thanks at all," Mr. Deasy said. "You have earned it."
Stephen's hand, free again, went back to the hollow shells. Symbols, too, of beauty and of power. A lump in my pocket. Symbols soiled by greed and misery.
"Don't carry it like that," Mr. Deasy said. "You'll pull it out somewhere and lose it. You just buy one of these machines. You'll find them very handy."
"Answer something. Mine would be often empty," Stephen said. The same room and hour, the same wisdom, and I the same. 3 times now, 3 nooses round me here. Well, I can break them in this instant if I will."
"Because you don't save," Mr. Deasy said, pointing his finger. "You don't know yet what money is. Money is power. When you have lived as long as I have, I know, I know. If youth but knew. But what does Shakespeare say? Put but money in thy purse."
"Iago," Stephen murmured. He lifted his gaze from the idle shells to the old man's stare.
"He knew what money was," Mr. Deasy said. "He made money. A poet, but an Englishman too. Do you know what is the pride of the English? Do you know what is the proudest word you will ever hear from an Englishman's mouth?"
"The sea's ruler." His sea-cold eyes looked on the empty bay. "History is to blame. On me. And on my words. On hating." "That honors empire," Stephen said. "The sun never sets."
"Bah!" Mr. Deasy cried. "That's not English. A French Celt said that."
He tapped his savings box against his thumbnail.
"I will tell you," he said solemnly. "What is his proudest boast? I paid my way."
"Good man, good man."
"I paid my way. I never borrowed a shilling in my life. Can you feel that? I owe nothing. Can you?"
"Mulligan, £9, 3 pairs of socks, 1 pair of brogues, ties. Curran, 10 guineas, McCann, 1 guinea, Fred Ryan, 2 shillings, Temple, 2 lunches, Russell, 1 guinea, Cousins, 10 shillings, Bob Reynolds, 1/2 guinea, Kohler, 3 guineas, Mrs. McKernan, 5 weeks' board. The lump I have is useless." "For the moment, no," Stephen answered. Mr. Deasy laughed with rich delight, putting back his savings box.
"I knew you couldn't," he said joyously. "But one day you must feel it. We are a generous people, but we must also be just."
"I fear those big words," Stephen said, "which make us so unhappy." Mr. Deasy stared sternly for some moments over the mantelpiece at the shapely bulk of a man in tartan filibegs. Albert Edward, Prince of Wales.
"You think me an old fogey and an old Tory," his thoughtful voice said. "I saw 3 generations since O'Connell's time. I remember the famine. Do you know that the Orange Lodges agitated for repeal of the Union 20 years before O'Connell did, or before the prelates of your communion denounced him as a demagogue? You Fenians forget some things."
"Glorious, pious, and immortal memory, the Lodge of Diamond and Armagh, the splendid behung with corpses of papishes. Horse, masked and armed, the Planter's Covenant, the Black North and True Blue Bible, Croppies Lie Down." Stephen sketched a brief gesture.
"I have rebel blood in me too," Mr. Deasy said, "on the Spindle side. But I am descended from Sir John Blackwood, who voted for the Union. We are all Irish, all king's sons.
Alas, Stephen said.
Per vias rectas, Mr. Deasy said firmly, was his motto. He voted for it and put on his top boots to ride to Dublin from the Ards of Down to do so.
Lowled around the rather rocky road to Dublin. A gruff squire on horseback with shiny top boots. Soft day, Sir John, soft day, Your Honour, day, day. Two top boots jogged dangly on to Dublin. Lowled around the rail, lowled around the
That reminds me, Mr. Deasy said. You can do me a favour, Mr. Dedalus, with some of your literary friends. I have a letter here for the press. Sit down a moment. I have just to copy the end.
He went to the desk near the window, pulled in his chair twice, and read off some words from the sheet on the drum of his typewriter.
Sit down, excuse me, he said over his shoulder. The dictates of common sense. Just a moment.
He peered from under his shaggy brows at the manuscript by his elbow, and muttering, began to prod the stiff buttons of the keyboard slowly, sometimes blowing as he screwed up the drum to erase an error. Stephen seated himself noiselessly before the princely presence. Framed around the walls, images of vanished horses stood in homage, their meek heads poised in air. Lord Hastings Repulse, the Duke of Westminster Shotover, the Duke of Beaufort Ceylon, Prix de Paris, 1866. Elfin riders sat them, watchful of a sign. He saw their speeds, back in King's colours, and shouted with the shouts of vanished crowds.
Full stop, Mr. Deasy bade his keys. But prompt ventilation of this important question.
Where Cranley led me to get rich quick, hunting his winners among the mud-splashed breaks, amid the balls of bookies on their pitches and reek of the canteen over the motley slush. Even money fair rebel 10-1 the field. Dicers and tumble riggers we hurried by after the hooves, the vine caps and jackets, and past the meat-faced woman, a butcher's dame, nuzzling thirstily her clove of orange. Shouts rang shrill from the boys' playfield, and a whirring whistle. Again, a goal. I am among them, among their battling bodies in a medley, the joust of life. You mean the knock-kneed mother's darling, who seems to be slightly cross-sick? Jousts. Time shocked, rebounds. Shock by shock. Jousts, slush and uproar of battles, the frozen death spew of the slain, a shout of spear spikes baited with men's bloodied guts.
Now then, Mr. Deasy said, rising.
He came to the table, pinning together his sheets. Stephen stood up.
I have put the matter into a nutshell, Mr. Deasy said. It's about the foot-and-mouth disease. Just look through it. There can be no two opinions in the matter.
May I trespass on your valuable space? That doctrine of laissez-faire which so often in our history, our cattle trade, the way of all our old industries, Liverpool, Ring, which jockeyed the Galway Harbour scheme, European conflagration, crane supplies through the narrow waters of the Channel, the pluter-perfect imperturbability of the Department of Agriculture, pardoned classical allusion, Cassandra, by a woman who was no better than she should be, to come to the point at issue.
I don't mince words, do I?
Mr. Deasy asked, as Stephen read on, foot-and-mouth disease known as Cox